Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And the thing I'm going to be talking about today is the Leninist Red Terror of 1918, which obviously continues throughout the Civil War. There are a number of ways to think about the Red Terror. Historians and supporters of Lenin have a kind of a largely very generous way of thinking about this. And they suggest that Lenin never intended to carry on the Red Terror for a long period of time. It wasn't intended to be a permanent feature of the state. What it was intended to do really was to create a classless society by killing off the seemingly unnecessary or enemy classes, the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy, and then reducing everybody else to the level of worker. This was Lenin discussed the idea of educating the country in socialism. This is part of what he meant. There was a whole move in the early years of the revolution to really proletarianise society. The creation of things like work dormitories for men and women and creches for children so that the good new proletarians of Russia wouldn't need to have to worry about the upbringing of their children and wouldn't be constrained by the bourgeois norms of the nuclear family. These kinds of things were pioneered with relative different levels of success. The idea that all workers now, or everybody now, works for the food that they get. There is precious little socialism introduced after October 1917. Instead, more extreme versions of the change in the relationship between state and the individual come to pass. Shoveling snow and doing other essential defence work, digging ditches, helping to do whatever it took to mobilise the new Red Army. These were the kinds of things that you got fed for. There were different classifications as to who ate what, and the lack of food, the famines, the shortages, the disruption to the food system serves Lenin immeasurably. By being able to reclassify certain people as unnecessary eaters, particularly the bourgeoisie, you got to reward your new working class supporters. Class, after October 1917, became the paradigm through which all things were perceived and interpreted. For example, the Cheka, who I'll talk about more in a moment, the new revolutionary secret police, were explicitly there the quote is, to bring about a revolutionary settlement of accounts, which really is, they are the force there to liquidate the bourgeoisie. So why all this insistence on wiping out an entire class of people? Well, if you go back to reading Marx and Lenin, the bourgeoisie are the class of people that are meant to kind of be phased out anyway. They're meant to become historically irrelevant. The future belongs to the workers. Lenin decides, I mean, there's nothing explicitly in Marx that says kill them all. He does talk about the dictatorship of the proletariat, a term that's been open to interpretation many, many times. And there are references to authoritarian measures, to terror within there. Lenin really takes that and clarifies it as he sees it, puts it into a much clearer framework, and says that there will be, at the end of his revolution, there will be fewer Russians but better ones. Unnecessary Russians will not continue in his new order. And in order to shape the the debate really in Russia in 1918 in terms of being class struggle. The bourgeoisie have to be presented as being the enemy class, the supporters of the whites, the counter-revolutionaries, the enemy within, the dangerous other. And as a result, not only is there official violence, arrests, detentions, executions against the bourgeoisie, but on a far greater scale, there's this huge unofficial violence that is encouraged by Lenin's writings and things like Pravda, which really whip up a storm. He demands that the people expropriate the expropriators, steal from the thieves. And there is widespread violence in public places, often fatal, against the bourgeoisie. It's essential, really, for things to be interpreted in this light in order for anything that the Bolsheviks are trying to do in Russia to make any kind of sense at all. Now, there is a wonderful quote from Martin Latsis, who was the chief of the Ukrainian Cheka, and when he's explaining the whys and wherefores of executing people or arresting people, he said, "Do not look in the file of incriminating evidence to see whether or not the accused rose up against the Soviets with arms or words. Ask him instead to which class he belongs, what his background, his education, his profession is. These are the questions that will determine the fate of the accused. That is the meaning and the essence of Red Terror." The Bolsheviks believed they were these sort of arch-interpreters of history, that they had seen Marx's dialectic and they understood how history worked. And really, the phase of history that they were entering might be bloody, but it was essential. That they were the kind of the butchers of history. They had, or the surgeons, they had to chop off the infected, the gangrenous flesh, that which was not productive, that did not strive, that was not able to work for its daily bread. The idea being, obviously, that the great crime that the bourgeoisie were guilty of in Lenin's eyes was to capitalise on surplus labour, i.e. to pay a worker less than the fruits of his labour generated and thus cream off the difference. This was exploitation, this was capitalism, and this was the supreme evil in Lenin's eyes. Which is why later on, when Lenin is forced, in the aftermath of the Civil War in 1921, to introduce the new economic policy, saying that small-level capitalism had to be allowed to flourish in Russia and there was no indication that it might not last for decades, even, you know, a century. The Bolsheviks are horrified. You know, Lenin has seen the brutal economic realities of the situation Russia's in, but the left of the Bolsheviks who fought this bloody civil war are wondering, really, well, what was all that for? Why have we gone to made all these sacrifices? But that's a story for later on. One of the first institutions that Lenin establishes in 1917 is the Cheka, the All-Russian Emergency Commission, beg your pardon, for combating counter-revolution and sabotage. It has, in theory, some kind of official legal aspect to it. In theory, the Cheka were meant to do the arrests and take the supposed guilty to revolutionary tribunals where their fate would be decided, normally exiled to one of the new labour camps soon to become part of the Gulag system, or execution. But the Cheka very quickly shift towards this paramilitary style of operating and simply do the executions to speed up the process. They were led by a Polish aristocrat called Felix Dzerzhinski, a man who had spent most of his life in the Tsar's prisons. Supposedly, when you saw him with his torso, it was crisscrossed with scars and whip marks, and so he had learned most of what he knew about violence and torture from the jailers of the Tsarist regime, and probably from the inmates as well. The Cheka was officially founded on December the 7th, 1917. It had a clear and ambiguous mandate, which was to liquidate to the root all the counter-revolutionary and sabotage activities and all attempts to them in all of Russia, to hand over counter-revolutionaries and saboteurs to the revolutionary tribunals, as previously mentioned, they very often took justice into their own hands, develop measures to combat them and relentlessly apply them in real-world applications, the Commission should only conduct a preliminary investigation. Initially, its powers are relatively slender. Things such as the confiscation of ration cards and the naming and shaming of counter-revolutionary enemies, that sort of thing was what it was mandated to do. But it was almost inconceivable that that's where its actions would end. The issue of food, food scarcity in Russia at the time, was one that the Cheka was chiefly involved in. The crime of speculation, i.e. hoarding food, was seen through a Marxist paradigm as being the prime sin. One hoards food with the expectation that the price will go up, therefore you can sell to your hungry fellow proletarians and make a killing into the process. This bumped you from being simply an ordinary criminal to being a political one. Of course, in hungry times, what do? They store food because that's how people survive. But refusal to see it in such terms, to see it in overtly politicised terms, led for many simply hungry Russians to face the full wrath of the Cheka. It took nearly a full year for the Cheka to go from being a threat, an ominous threat to many bourgeois Russians, to being a full-fledged instrument of terror. And it's the attempted assassination of Lenin in September 1918 by Fanya Kaplan, a social revolutionary, who that really gives the Cheka the opportunity they need. They can then publicise the idea that there is a widespread counter-revolutionary conspiracy, that the bourgeoisie are in on it and they're attempting to overthrow the revolution, and that's what this is all about. And it gives them a mandate to really be let off the leash. And this is really, from this point onwards, really where the Red Terror really explodes. The civil war that's begun at the start of 1918 has been mounting, and the armies of the white generals have been accumulating in the interior of Russia. And the combination of the two things, the assassination and the development of the civil war, really give a massive mandate to the Cheka to take the Red Terror to the heights that I think Lenin probably had always envisaged, and the thoroughness that Dzerzhinsky wanted. By the first few months of 1918, the Cheka had gone nationwide. The Soviets across Russia had been sent a telegram by Dzerzhinsky to order them to establish commissions or Chekas in their local area. And what oversight there had been of the Cheka, obviously, given the vast distances, the chaos, the war and the brutality within Russia at that time, is certainly affected. There are autonomous Cheka units doing unspeakably violent things to people who have almost no case to answer in terms of the criteria of the revolutionary tribunals across Russia. And the autonomy of the Cheka in Yekaterinburg is one of the reasons really why the Tsar is executed. The conversation about what to do with the Tsar is had by telegram between Yekaterinburg and Moscow. And there is a high degree of autonomy at the Yekaterinburg end. Not that Lenin was particularly upset, though Trotsky was keen on having the Tsar transported back to Moscow to put him on trial. And one theory, not my theory, I'll admit to that one, if you read Orlando Feige's Russia, A People's Tragedy, very good overview of the whole situation, his theory is that Lenin really tried to spike Trotsky's guns. He didn't want Trotsky to have the glory of putting the Tsar on trial for an eventual firing squad and to appear to be the great figure of the revolution. Far better to have the Tsar shot along with the rest of his family while they were out of the way in the east part of Russia. Cheka come into their own during the Russian Civil War. They were a very useful tool for maintaining military discipline in the by 1921, in the huge Red Army that has been built on mass conscription. the threat of executions of any retreating forces really do tend to motivate and focus the thoughts of Trotsky's troops during the Civil War. The other key role that they perform in the Civil War as the administrators of terror isn't against the bourgeoisie, but against the peasants. The requisitions, the period known as war communism, where Lenin essentially said that all grain could be requisitioned from farms, including even seed grain, thus resulting in famine. Part of this process was to, you know, break the peasantry and make the eventual collectivization of the peasantry easier. But also Lenin looked upon the peasants as being a dangerous reactionary bunch. I think I've mentioned this one before in previous podcasts. The peasant revolution during 1917 had happened largely independent of anything the Bolsheviks had done, and there had simply been an uprising and a mass killing of landlords in the countryside. So you have open anarchy in the countryside and new kind of new relationships, new forms, new structures really sort of emerging. And once all the pieces have been thrown up in the countryside, when things start to settle, you get new peasants with a sense of empowerment. This is definitely something that you have to break if you're Lenin, and you have to use the opportunities that the Civil War gives you. So the Cheka carried out waves of executions in the countryside when they found peasants hoarding grain, but during famines this is the one thing that peasants definitely do. The crackdown by the under war communism prevented any kind of free trade, which would have seen, be seen as this kind of bourgeois speculation. Therefore, peasants with carts of food that went to the cities to sell at market in order to, you know, make a bit of money for themselves so they could survive and feed the starving cities. These people are also seen as class enemies and class traitors, and either executed or thrown into jail. It's a catastrophic idea by Lenin, and it is responsible not only for famine in the countryside, but for famine conditions in towns and cities as well. And it brings Russia to its knees. The Civil War would probably have been won by the Bolsheviks much quicker had they actually used the peasantry and allowed the peasantry to work a market system to feed the towns and cities. But that's ideology for you. The senior Bolsheviks view themselves as these kind of midwives of history, giving birth, whether a birth pangs, you know, painful convulsions to a new historical era. And they knew it's not going to be nice, it's going to be bloody, but it'll be worth it. And they have this utopian vision that the end result will be so fantastic that all the suffering to get there is entirely justified. And it's probably some of the senior Chekists think the same things. Some of the more junior ones, perhaps not quite as educated, have a more simple view of what is going on. This idea of bourgeois, or bourgeois, as it becomes sort of bastardised in Russian, this means bad. Means, you know, liar, cheat, crook, con man, enemy of the people. Very often, to some of the Czechists, it probably meant Jew. The one thing that the Russian Revolution certainly doesn't stamp out in Russia after 1917 is anti-Semitism, even though many of the leading Bolsheviks are Jews themselves. So they have a simple code that they live by. You find your enemies, you kill them. And as far as the ideological toings and froings go, well, you know, don't worry about those too much. But this is often the way with the shock troops of new dictatorships. Probably a great deal of the brown shirts under Hitler had never read Mein Kampf cover to cover. And if they'd have managed to sort of pick out his argument, they might not have articulated it particularly. Themes like restoration of Germany and getting the Jews were, you know, simple motifs. Anyway, I hope that's been useful. Now, if you're just starting back at college, at university, or at school this autumn, and you're doing the Russian Revolution, you can download a number of ebooks at www.explaininghistory.com. Firstly, you can get Chris Kostov's The Communist Century. You might also find useful my very own Explaining the Russian Revolution, a Student's Guide. I've written two other ebooks on this very subject, Russia's Struggle with Modernity and Stalin, the Five-Year Plans and the Gulags, 1929-53. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there for you, and look on our free stuff giveaways page. There's loads of downloadable resources there as well. I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.